Is that the new intro?
No. Yeah, I'm so excited. Today we're going to talk to Sajid Rahman. He's a very experienced investor and a coach, and he also runs a startup, but then he moonlighted as an angel investor on AngelList. Most of his career has been in Asia and Africa, but then he also has venture partner around the world to help him co-syndicate with a lot of his deals. Actually, we also co-syndicated one deal with him before as well, and that's why we got him here to speak with us. Excited to learn a lot more about how he's so super productive and being able to do so many things at the same time, and the challenges that he's faced since he started as an angel investor, and how he even got involved as a corporate person, you know, how he ever got into startup. Yeah, what do you want to learn from him, Lauren?
Yeah, love to understand more about his international crossword experience, how he evaluates early stage startups where there's not a lot of signals out there, and how does he handle all the syndicates? It's quite an amazing number, over 700. So
yeah, I think he's like one of the hottest syndicate group on the AngelList. It's like always something. I'm in his syndicates group and like he's always sending me something, so it's kind of crazy. All right, so let's talk to Sajid. Welcome, Sajid. Thank you so much for joining us for our podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for inviting.
Yeah, I'm excited to learn about your journey of because I know your AngelList is one of the most active ones, because I talked to other AngelList syndicate as well, and I know that since you're so active, AngelList also want to ask you start a rolling fund. So I just want to learn a bit about who you are and then like how you're able to do all this in such a short time.
Yeah. Thanks. So maybe I give how I ended up in the investment world. That would be a good start. So I am an accidental investor. I never planned. I spend a lot of my time working in different international organizations across the world. A typical corporate person, so we're never, you know, thinking of investing or going into startup investments. But while I was running a bank here in Jakarta, Indonesia, I was approached by a couple of founders. They were just trying; they're just starting their fintech company, companies and sites. And they wanted me to help them as advisor going through the regulatory landscape, how to position the company, how to connect with the regulators, all those areas. So I started investing those young chaps, three of them. And then at one point they were raising a fund, sort of an angel fund. They already had a few investors. So I also invested in that that company with other investors. That was actually my first startup investment. And from that time on, there were other investors on the cap table. They sort of showed me the ropes on how to find companies, where to invest, all those stuff. And that really
so it's through other investors. So what about the founders? Did the founders also introduce you to other people?
Yeah, so that's how it started in both ways. So first, of course, with the other investors. And then, as the company continued to grow, founders started introducing to other investors.
I know that you also have a job as well. This is not your only thing. So how do you manage it right now?
It's tough. I think, COVID-19, this whole work from home sort of pushed me into this syndicate and other things. But it's tough. I mean, I work in a digital health company, which is obviously very busy with all the activities that's going on. So, yeah. It's difficult to balance the two.
So what are your hours like? Like, when do you spend time on your syndicates and your fun? When do you spend time on your work? Is it mingle up
it's
together?
Actually, yeah, it's sort of you know, there's no beginning or end. It's just a continuum. So, you know, I start, let's say, 7 a.m. Every day. One thing is most of the startups are in another time zone, mostly in US or, you know, in that time zone. So I take a lot of calls in the morning from 7 till 9, 10 a.m. And then, of course, you know, my work starts, so which is sort of usually from, you know, like 10 to 6, 5, 6 p.m. and then again. So, you know, usually 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day.
So, like, what makes you want to do startup investing? Because there are other ways, there are other things that you can invest in. There's like real estate, there is just stock market. Why ventures? What attracts you?
So I think there are, you know, three distinct advantage or, you know, a difference between a startup investments to a public market or the or real estate. First is, you know, startup investment is where as an investor, I can somehow influence the outcome. In a public market, you know, if you're investing in one of those large companies, you are just a shareholder and your luck is essentially tied with whatever the company does or other large shareholders in the board of the decisions they make. In case of startups, because you're, especially us, we're investing so early where a company maybe having, you know, like 5-10 employees just starting. So we can really introduce the startup founders to different opportunities, networks, other investors. So we can really, you know, in a way influence the outcome. So that's one. Second is, as a startup investor, I sort of have a front seat of exact what's happening in the technology world, in the innovation world. Very close look. You know, some of the companies I invested are deep tech, and the experiments they're doing are very, you know, very inspiring to watch. So that gives a very front row seat of all these innovations. And the third, I think, you know, investing in startup is a high learning process. It really steeps you into a crash course of business building and learning of how a business grow and scale. And that's where I think my day job and these investments are interlinked. Whatever I'm learning from the day job, I can transfer to the startup investments and vice versa.
So how big is the startup that you're working, is a health tech company, right? Like, is that also a startup? Is that what you're saying?
The other one that I'm running?
Yes.
Yeah. It is sort of a startup, though, you know, it's part of a very large group, but it's the way it is structured is as a separate company where, you know, so where I, as a founder, I started the whole thing from recruitment of the company to employees, to funding, to actual growth. Product development, everything. So it's essentially building a company from scratch, which is now quite big, which now serve 6 million people, digital health, from remotely. So it's going very fast.
So I see you have quite a number of really awesome investments. You mentioned Hyperloop, Zendrive, Ship, diverse group of industries. How do you get smart across all these sectors? Have any secrets lost to share with our listeners?
So it's sort of, you know, one of the things I do is, I won't, you know, term myself as smart in all the, sectors I invest in. I have a broad idea about the investment, but I may not have the deep knowledge, especially in cases where it's, where it's something like very deep science, like space economies and stuff. I have a very good idea about the marketplaces, health tech, fintech, you know, e-commerce and all those things. So the way I approach my investments are, especially in three ways. First is, of course, you know, who else are investing. So if there are, you know, strong institutional VCs who has led the round, so that helps me to get some sort of comfort. And in that case, I would be talking with the lead investors to get an idea of the due diligence process and how they selected the company or decided to invest in the company. So that would be one. I would do quite a bit of reading on the topic before deciding to invest or before talking to lead investors. So that also, you know, helped me. And third, of course, you know, the interview that I do with the founders, I have a couple of checklists in my mind, you know, in terms of the product, the ideas, the tractions, the founder background, you know, the co-investor. So that gives me an idea of whether this would be a good investment or not. If there are companies which is completely beyond my understanding, I mean, even all this reading connecting doesn't help, then I skip those.
When you're evaluating companies, do you have two or three go-to rule of thumbs that you can, you often rely on to quickly make that initial assessment?
Yeah, so first would be my interview with the founders, especially if it's a team. And if I'm talking with two or three founders together, one of the things I try to understand, and which is sort of not impossible, but difficult over Zoom call, but which I try to understand is the founder dynamics. You know, when I ask a question, how one founder is replying compared to the other founder and whether they're intercepting each other or stuff like that. So just to understand the founder dynamics, that sort of gives me an instinct whether the team or the core team will work well or not. So that would be one. Second would be, you know, of course, who the other, I mean, I rarely invest the first time in a company. I usually see who the others are in the cap table. So strong names on the cap table usually help me to make the decision faster. So those would be, that would be the second one. And third, of course, you know, the one basic question that I try to understand is monetization and path. And if they are monetizing, what is the sort of the numbers looking like? So you know, so sort of get an idea on the year-on-year or month-to-month growth of the company.
So the team, the co-investors, and also on how they monetize. These are the three things. Okay, cool. So I know you're not based out of the US. Where, what city exactly are you at? We have 12 hours difference, huh?
Yeah, I'm in Jakarta.
Indonesia. Yeah, so how is that, I mean, I don't really know how it works. Like maybe you can also educate our audience. Like, so Angel List from Jakarta, like how does it work differently, like with the tax, you know, is there any tax implication, like how is it different, like versus someone who is from the US getting foreign investor, like how would that platform affect us?
So AngelList is a US-based platform. All our investments are through SPV in US. So from a company which is located in US, it's just another US SPV, US company, SPV investing in the company. So the tax implication would be similar, like another, you know, fund based in US investing in. And of course, all these funds are flow through, right? So you essentially don't, you know, accrue tax at the fund level, but on the individual, you know, investor level. For me, based out of Jakarta, I think there are goods and bads, you know, of the coin. Because AngelList is US-based and because I'm in Jakarta, so, you know, there's a novelty value, i.e., you know, there's someone who is not based in US who has access to a lot of deals in Asia, in emerging markets, and also, of course, quite a few deals in US. So that helps me to attract an LP base who likes to have access to these emerging market deals. So that clearly helps me to position myself separately among all the other syndicate leads. So that's one. The good thing about the platform is I can be anywhere in the world and, you know, access investments. And that's where I think AngelList is playing a very big role in democratizing access to those deals. You know, someone based in Jakarta or Singapore or, you know, anywhere else, let's say in Brazil, otherwise would not have had access to deals like, you know, Hyperloop or, you know, Axiom Space and stuff like that. So that really opens up the door. For me, it's good. It's a good experience so far.
So what's the most unexpected region you've made investments in so far?
Region would be difficult. I mean, you know, so I invest a lot in Africa, Latin, of course, Europe, I mean, all the continents, so to speak. In the region, I think, you know, I have been... El Salvador might be not a typical, you know, investment destination. So yeah, so that would be off the, you know, beaten path Yeah, quite a few companies. I mean, I don't know with the Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire is a Francophone country, is a Francophone, you know, in Africa. So that would be, again, off the beaten path, yeah.
So really, so you just invest all over the world. Like, is that your strategy to just be super diverse and see what happens location-wise?
Yeah. Yeah, true. I mean, there has all this saying nowadays that very large firms like Sequoias and Lightspeed and all these guys are, setting up shops across the world. Working on the hypothesis that opportunity is limited, but talent not. So what we are seeing is talents are, you can get talents across the world. There are good companies in all those places to invest. The only thing that we probably need to remember is the legal and tax implications of investing in those companies. So the company that I invest, for example, in Francophone or El Salvador, they would be registered in US. So we are essentially would be investing in a US entity who are doing businesses in other geographies.
Okay, so you have them all kind of registered in the US, is that what you're saying?
So there are a couple of jurisdictions where we invest. So one is US, one is Singapore, one is Europe, like UK, France, one is Canada. Yeah. So essentially, a company for all practical purposes may be working, let's say, in Jakarta or in El Salvador, 99% of the business may be in those countries, but they are registered US entity or Singapore entity.
Have you explored what's the negative? If it's, let's say, Australia, do you know like some of the countries why you wouldn't want to invest in the ones that are registered there?
Yeah, so I mean, we do. Australia would be okay. Or, we are just doing one in Ireland. So those are okay. I think the question is more of the, tax implication for countries, which is not very clear. So, if we're investing in a country where we are not very clear on the tax implications or jurisdictions or investor rights, so then we will probably, suggest the company to be registered in one of those jurisdictions.
You have been very prolific in your investments. Are there any special, what does your investment stack look like? Are you Finity? Do you have other folks helping you manage all the tracking of performances?
So I am sort of a single person show, so to speak, I haven't started recruiting a team, but what I have a very strong network of venture partners who refer deals to me. So the way it's working now is we have people all over the world, people based in Africa, in Latin, of course, US, Canada, Singapore, who are referring deals to me, and I share carry with them. So that really helped me to source a lot of deals. But on the back end side, still, a single person managing it.
Just one person. Like, I feel like you must be super productive. Like, you probably have some like high performing habits. Like, what's like a good hack that you do that really like it's like time saving, because I feel like I'm running out of time every day.
It's I think there are a couple of hacks you can say. One is, of course, is really have blocks of time to do things, so not let one agenda from one block get jump into another agenda, so that helps. So really have blocks of time to do things. And that, that also, relates to, how much time I spend on, on my exercises, physical activities and stuff like that. So we get those sort of circled out. That's one. And and second would probably be, being able to multitask. So, doing sometimes one or two things within that block at a time. So that helps to probably manage time. And third, of course, be able to make very quick decisions. So I think sometimes I see people lingering on a decision for a while, which may in the end does not improve the quality of decision. So yeah, being able to make decisions quickly actually save a lot of time.
That's true, especially with early stage startup. There's only so much information you can get out of them. right? So it's like, think, you know, you sometimes you just have to go with what you have already and then make the, your best judgment too. Is there, like, you know, thinking back, like, your journey in investing, is there anything that you wish you would have done differently?
Oh, many. you know, investing is sort of an, you know, like this apprentice, you know, discipline. So it's something once only a person dips their, you know, dips his toes, the person really starts in accumulating the experience and really get into it. So, I mean, we can read a lot of books, listen to a lot of, you know, interviews, but unless you are investing real dollars, you don't start accumulating that experience. And of course, you know, I did my part of it. Yeah. So, I mean, one learning would be to, I mean, initially I was writing check sizes quite randomly, you know, some with, you know, 10K, some with 15K, some with 25K, you know. So I started writing, you know, I started learning to write uniform checks, how to, you know, hold on to pro rata. But I guess the biggest learning that one develops through startup investment is not something one can actually articulate, but something one, you know, sort of an instinct, sort of a trend recognizing, or they call pattern recognizing. So something when you see, let's say, you know, nowadays I probably see what, 6-7 startups every day, I over Zoom interviews and others. So once you do these 5-6 or, you know, interviews, talking with founders every day over 3-5 years, you develop a very good understanding of the pattern recognition, which will work, which won't work. You know, you sort of develop that. And I think that's the biggest learning.
Were there any like surprise win then? Like, I know, like, maybe you would feel like that at the moment you choose the right one, but after several years, I don't know how long your journey has been. Were there any ones that like, oh, I thought I made a bad decision on that one, but it turned out to be a good one. And then, or maybe you thought you did a great decision, made a great decision, and then it turned out really badly. Any surprise?
Oh, many. And that's where I think, you know, I mean, I don't know whether you, you know, I guess, I mean, we can say everything, but at the end of the day, you know, there's a big luck factor in investments. I don't want to take the credit of all these investors who are doing good, but I think at the end of the day, you know, building a company is so difficult. It's such a long journey. You're talking about, you know, anywhere between 6 to 10 years to see an exit, and sometimes longer. And so many things can go wrong. You know, we have startup founders who are really good, really bright, with all the good intentions, with all the good understanding, but some black swan even happened, you know, like, let's say this pandemic or whatever. And then, you know, the startup just probably, for some reason, the industry they're in didn't play out well. But of course, you know, I have also seen companies where, which are in difficult mode, and I thought this company is a write-off, but just because of the founder, who is really, really tenacious and went through it and actually ended up in a successful exit. So it's a very broad spectrum of results. And that's why it's always about the portfolio. Unlike other companies, startup investments is always about creating the portfolio and see some big returns.
We've about to hit or have already hit our 1-year anniversary on COVID. You wrote a few blog posts on the impact and how it's changed the markets. Just curious to understand, has those viewpoints shifted or evolved since then?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, so two things have happened, and it's sort of, you know, took a lot of investors by surprise. So, you know, the early days of COVID, we were all thinking, you know, we're going into a significant, you know, at least as far as, I mean, let's take a healthcare and a health impact outside, because that obviously is a pretty bad scenario played out across the world. But on the economic angle, we thought we'd be going into a big doom and gloom scenario where markets will tank. People will, you know, countries won't be able to feed its people, you know, emerging markets and all those stuff. But it didn't turn out to be that bad on the economic sense. Of course, there are economic pains in certain, you know, industries which are going through massive layoff, or, you know, at individual level, I'm sure. But if you look at the broader economic indicators, those are all doing, you know, extraordinarily strong. So when I started, you know, my initial blog post on Medium on COVID, and I thought, you know, we're going to go through an extended period of economic, you know, stagnation, you know, a lot of you know, maybe economic crisis, large companies going bankrupt and stuff like that. It actually didn't happen that way. The market played out completely differently. If we have seen companies like Boeing and others who have obviously gone through significant, you know, negatives and write-offs, but all those have significantly, you know, covered at the market level by the large technology companies, right? So that's why where the market is positive. There's a huge investment dollar. You can see the number of SPACs out there. Two of my portfolio companies are going through SPACs. So, you know, then there are more dollars out there than good companies at this stage. So I thought startups will go through a significant challenge in terms of raising, but it really didn't play out that way.
Congrats on the SPACs. That's amazing. Are there any trends that you feel are being ignored?
I won't say ignored, but I think, you know, it's a couple of things. Obviously, there has always been the question that, you know, the change that have been propelled, the changes that through this because of this pandemic, will it continue? And the general thesis has always been that it will continue to at least 50-60% of it, right? So, you know, this whole e-learning, distance learning, you know, digital health, payments upswing. But my view is that there would be a significant return to center, i.e., we probably won't see, you know, I think we are over ambitious in terms of the technology impact in the coming years, driven by COVID. I think it won't happen to that extent. I think people are desperate to go out and go back to, you know, to the old ways of life. So there'll be a huge surge. My gut feel is that the changes that we're seeing now will not be to the extent of 60%, but maybe 25-30%. So it will be much less in the longer term.
Got it. Cool. So just to wrap up here, just have a quick few questions for you. What's the last book or blog you've read?
Blog, I was just reading the, you know, A16Z blog. So they just, there was a, you know, it just came out in the morning. So I was going through it.
Okay, cool. What about a book?
The book would be, I was reading the recent Netflix book written, you know, by the founder. He just came out as an autobiographic, so I was just going through it.
Really all about founders for you. What about your favorite book?
Favorite would be 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. So that would be one of my favorite books.
Great. I think you kind of answered this a little bit. How much sleep do you exactly get every night?
Roughly 6 hours. Roughly, yeah, 6 hours, 6-7 hours. Yeah.
Got it. Three people most influential to you.
Huh. So, I think you know. So on the politics, I think Gandhi, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi. You know, who I find a very influential person in terms of the world politics and the way he pushed nonviolence, you know, as a strategy against violent movements. So I think that was a very influential, you know, influence at the arc of history at that time. The second one, of course, I would say in our modern day would be Elon Musk, given the, you know, the development, you know, given the companies that he's building. So not only his companies, but I think he is influencing a generation to take bets on deep science and build a career. So on a modern day, he would be one of the most influential character. And yeah, at a personal level, I obviously have many people, but I am always, you know, as an author, I mean, one of the books I find very interesting, I mean, one of the authors I find very interesting is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So I find his books has a lot of influence in me over time.
Great. Last question. What's a common myth about the work we do that you personally want to debunk?
I think one of the common myths is that startup investment is for people who has a lot of money, who has it's very high risk, you know, we shouldn't do it and stuff like that. And that's one of the reason I see people, you know, investing a lot in typical investments, but not doing startup investment. But my point is that, you know, everyone can start very small in startup investments. And it's one, if it is a portfolio method, it's actually not that risky on a portfolio level. So yeah, so I think more and more people should put money in startups.
I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I guess I know she said last question, but where can our listeners connect with you and how can we help with what you're doing?
Building on the last point. So I have a syndicate, Angelus Syndicate. So if anyone wants to go into startup investment, they can follow me there and see the deal flow. There is no commitment. One just follow that. One can connect me over LinkedIn. I'm active there on Twitter at Sajid Republic. So, on Twitter. And of course, if someone joins Angelus, then can also message me there.
Cool. Thanks. We'll have those. Maybe you can email that to us and then we'll have it in the show notes as well. And also that author that you really like, I want to share that too. Thank you so much.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks, Lauren.
Yeah, so that was a lot of stuff, like good stuff that we got from Sajid. What do you think was your biggest learning, Lauren?
Yeah, I think it was really amazing that one, Angelus is such a powerful platform. So I've seen it used for syndicates that I've never really considered for international investors. And I'm going to give it a second look, especially, I don't think we even talked about rolling funds either. So,
oh yeah. He also is starting his rolling fund. So what it is that if you are doing pretty well on AngelList, they do offer you to start a rolling fund as well on the platform. And I actually am a fan of AngelList because they are in a way democratizing investing. And it is a way to give access to things that some people don't have access to, right? But I think something to be wary of also is that you really have to do it with someone that you really trust, because you're really on AngelList, you're really just following whoever it is that's leading the deal. You're trusting the due diligence, you're trusting that they did their homework and they vetted the founders and the team and all the informations are correct. Those are some of the learning that I have. And I actually, he inspired me that you can have a full-time job and still do all these deals. Like, it's just all about creating a system. And what he said about making quick decision is true. Like, sometimes we think the longer we take to make a decision, you would have a better decision. But I think really with startup, a lot of time is your hunch.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And, I think having a system to quickly just punch through the decision making, I think that tremendously helps at the decision making process.
Yeah, and then I think at the end, the pattern recognition too. And I feel like this is the same thing with investing in real estate and other things as well. Like, it's almost like when you do something long enough, when you do something often enough, then you start to just know it in your body. One of my friends told me you can smell a good deal. Yeah, so next time we're gonna have Arlen. So really excited about that. All right, thanks for tuning in, guys. Bye.
Bye.